Face to Face with Kim Jong-un, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. CIA Director Mike Pompeo met with North Korea's leader recently, and this former U.S. official thinks that was probably a good thing.
Given the opportunity to meet face-to-face and ask him questions, I think it's not a bad idea to really get a sense of what's possible.
But when it comes to President Trump's planned meeting with Kim Jong-un, this Korea expert is worried.
This is a trap. Trump is walking right into it.
Plus, remembering the woman who helped prove continental drift, a cartographer at Columbia University.
In an atmosphere where every faculty member at Columbia University was adamantly anti-continental drift.
All men, of course. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Thanks for joining us today. President Trump says it all went very smoothly. He was referring to a top-secret meeting between CIA Director Mike Pompeo and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The two sat down together in Pyongyang over Easter weekend. I know. Wow. Trump has also tweeted to say details of a possible Trump-Kim summit are being worked out. But is North Korea, in fact, willing to talk about giving up its nuclear weapons? There's a lot of disagreement about that. We turn first to Michelle Flournoy, who was a top-ranking official at the Pentagon in the Obama administration. Michelle, did the news that CIA Chief Mike Pompeo had touched down in Pyongyang come as a surprise to you?
Well, I think it came as a surprise to everyone because he had just been on Capitol Hill for his confirmation hearings and had been asked about preparations for the North Korea meeting and hadn't said anything. So I think it was a surprise in that sense. But it wasn't in the sense that historically the U.S. and North Korea, because they don't have any formal diplomatic relations, have traditionally used an intelligence channel to actually communicate and set up meetings in the past.
So you believe he was going genuinely as CIA chief as opposed to CIA chief Kum, Secretary of State?
Well, it's probably hard to separate. I think what was unusual is that he actually went in person and saw Kim Jong-un. Usually this is via phone, fax, email kind of exchange. It's been rarely in person. And when it has been in person, it's been at a working level intelligence channel, not the director of the CIA and the leader of the country.
Is this person-to-person meeting in Pyongyang a good move for Washington to have made?
You know, I wish they had sort of been more transparent about it on the American side with the Congress and the public, but I actually think one of the key challenges in such a closed society is taking the measure of the North Korean leader and what his intentions really are. And given the opportunity to meet face-to-face and have a dialogue and ask him questions and follow-up questions, I think it's not a bad idea to really get a sense of what's possible. You know, what are his objectives? Is there any real overlap with the United States' objectives or not?
But the fact that it took place on Kim Jong-un's home turf in Pyongyang, couldn't it be a cynical ploy by North Korea to gain a victory over its nemesis?
Well, North Korea is always looking for recognition as a normal, acknowledged power. And preferably, they'd like to be acknowledged as a nuclear power. So there's always a danger of being played when any senior official visits. But in this case, because it was private, it wasn't public, I think the risks of that were not substantial in this particular case. My biggest concern is that we don't seem to have a very developed articulation of what our bottom line objectives are for this meeting and what's the negotiating strategy for getting there.
Getting back to Mike Pompeo, how does it look to the rest of the world when the head of the CIA is acting as America's chief diplomat?
Not good. I mean, one of the challenges right now across the board in this administration is a real absence of diplomatic representation. You know, from the top, we don't have a Secretary of State, but also below that, we don't have ambassadors in key countries like South Korea. We don't have diplomatic representatives who are ready and able to engage in some of these high priority negotiations, whether it's with North Korea or with regard to Syria or with regard to peace talks in Afghanistan.
The new National Security Advisor, John Bolton, has publicly advocated for overthrowing the North Korean government. How will his point of view add to the mix, given that they seem to be going down a diplomatic route?
Well, my worry is that, you know, if the diplomatic route is not well prepared, meaning they don't have a very clear sense of objectives and how they're going to get there and interim measures along the way, you could end up with a meeting that ends in frustration on both sides, where, you know, if President Trump walks away and says they're not serious, that's the end of diplomacy, then John Bolton's there to whisper in his ear, okay, let's take care of this militarily. And that could create a very high-risk situation.
Do you have a sense of where John Bolton's point of view, whether it has a lot of currency in the administration?
I think it has currency with the president. I don't think it has currency in the Department of Defense. I think the Department of Defense has studied a large number of Korean scenarios over many, many years, and they have a very deep understanding of the costs and risks associated with escalation to an all-out conflict. And so I think they will be pushing for, you know, continuing with diplomacy in a more serious way.
In your heart of hearts, do you think that there's a there? Do you think that the U.S. and North Korea are really engaged upon a serious dialogue that could result in something? Or do you think this is going through the motions on the part of North Korea, as it's done in many instances in the past?
I think because of the history of so many broken agreements in the past, we have to be clear-eyed and skeptical. That said, I think we always should have the door open to serious talks. But those talks need preparation. Right now, we're talking a little bit past each other. When we say, we the U.S. say denuclearization, we're thinking about the North Korean regime getting rid of its nuclear weapons. When they say denuclearization, they're thinking about the reunification of the peninsula. And under that context, everybody getting rid of nuclear weapons, including the U.S. nuclear guarantee to South Korea and likely the U.S. force presence and alliance with South Korea. So I think denuclearization means very different things to the two sides, which is where the details matter.
Michelle Flournoy served as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under President Obama. Thanks a lot, Michelle.
Thank you.
For a different take, let's turn to Sungyoon Lee. He's a professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Here's his reading on that secret meeting between Mike Pompeo and Kim Jong-un.
It shows you that President Trump himself is quite committed to meeting with the North Korean leader. Mr. Trump might ask himself at this point a question of basic logic, which is, at which point between Vice President Mike Pence's invalidation of North Korea's outreach to South Korea during the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics, when Mr. Pence called North Korea's outreach a charade, and the South Korean envoy's visit to the White House on March 8th, did the North Korean leader's intentions become not fake? Kim Jong-un has been planning for this, to change his tune from molto agitato to placido after that banner ballistic year last year, to put on a nice face and get the U.S. to prematurely relax sanctions so that he can buy time and money with which to perfect his own nuclear posture review. This is a trap. Trump is walking right into it.
But there's other countries involved that have been dealing with North Korea for decades, South Korea, Japan, the U.S. There's a whole lot of China. There's a whole lot of people with seasoned diplomats and a sense of kind of how this works. I mean, do you feel like the whole diplomatic establishment is being snookered?
Well, they are, but many of these countries don't really mind North Korea having a nuclear arsenal. China, Russia certainly don't. South Korea actually lives under the illusion that these nukes and ICBMs are targeted at the United States, South Korea's sole treaty ally, so South Koreans don't need to fear. And you see what's happening. Kim Jong-un, just by flashing a few smiles, sending his sister to South Korea and calling for a summit meeting with the U.S. president, has now been able to line up the leaders of the biggest, most powerful, richest nations in the world for a meeting, a summit meeting. And that is the way that Kim will become the de facto accepted leader of a nuclear state. That's his endgame, to draw out the so-called denuclearization process, negotiation process, as long as he can, so that his nuclear weapons and ICBMs become fait accompli, and the U.S. learns to live not only with the big brother, but also a nuclear North Korea.
What are the advantages or disadvantages of using intelligence instead of diplomacy to communicate with North Korea?
I think this is unconventional. It's hard for me to imagine that the head of MI6, the British intelligence, would fly over to North Korea and conduct actual negotiations. I realize Mr. Pompeo is due to be Secretary of State, but I think this kind of clandestine channel of communication probably works in North Korea's favor, because once again, it shows you how desperate, how eager the United States is to negotiate with North Korea. The U.S. has not yet gained the financial economic leverage to put some hurt on the North Korean regime. That will come after about 3 years, at least, of tough sanctions enforcement, and we are not there yet.
From where you're sitting right now, do you think this possible summit between Kim Jong-un and President Trump will actually take place?
It may fall apart, but it seems that it is going to take place because both leaders want it. The U.S. doesn't want to escalate. At no point since the end of the Korean War 65 years ago has the United States or its ally, South Korea, resorted to any kind of military response in the face of egregious lethal attacks by North Koreans. So North Korea, even with conventional weapons alone, has managed to thoroughly deter the most powerful country in the world, even in the 60s and 70s. So North Korea assumes it can get away with murder. And North Korea is now changing its tune. And this is a post-provocation fake peace ploy. And Americans really need to be aware of North Korea's strategic endgame.
Sung-yoon Lee is a professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Thanks, Professor Lee.
Thank you for having me.
Now here's a reminder that the North Korean government has done some pretty nefarious things in the past. One episode concerns one of the Korean peninsula's most beloved actresses, Cho Eun-hee.
She used to be called the Queen of Cinema.
That's my colleague Soo-min Hwang of the BBC's Korean service. She says Cho was one of South Korea's most popular celebrities in the 1960s and 70s, but by 1978, her career was in a slump.
This was when North Korean spies approached her and lured her, posing as a Hong Kong businessman, and said, "Why don't you come to Hong Kong? We'll discuss some business."
Cho went and was kidnapped on the orders of Kim Jong-il, the now deceased father of current leader Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-il was a notorious film buff, so he decided to have Cho and her film director ex-husband forcibly brought to North Korea to make movies.
They did for 8 years. Shin Sang-wook directed the films and Cho Eun-hee starred in the films, making propaganda films for the North Korean government. And one of her films actually won an award at the Moscow Film Festival at one point.
Eventually, Soo-min Hwang says, Cho and her ex-husband won the confidence of the North Korean regime, at least enough to be allowed to travel abroad.
They were under very heavy guard, but while they were in Vienna, they managed to escape and sought asylum. They sought political asylum at the U.S. embassy,
which was granted. It was a suitably dramatic end to a dramatic chapter in the life of South Korean actress Cho Eun-hee. She returned to her life as a celebrity in South Korea, where Cho died this week at the age of 91. A quick look ahead now. Coming up, we'll hear from one of the women who first spoke out against the abuses of Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein, Asia Argento, the well-known Italian actress and also the most prominent voice of the Me Too movement in Italy. But then came the backlash. Argento was criticized by many Italians. She was even blamed for the sexual assault she suffered. Argento calls it a character assassination.
All the other victims coming from the States or the same predator were not assassinated in their character the way I was. So I know that it's because of me and because of what I've been, you know, free with my word, free with my body, free as a woman, free to say what I want and unafraid to break this stereotype of the silent bourgeois actress who's submitted toward the male-dominated film world in Italy.
We'll hear more from Italian actress Asia Argento later on the show. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. Plate tectonics, continental drift, things we take for granted now as scientific facts, but back in the late 1950s...
At that time, the idea of continental drift was no-no.
That's geologist Bill Ryan. He was working at Columbia University back then with a cartographer named Marie Tharp. Tharp's work mapping the Atlantic Ocean floor led her to question the scientific thinking at the time about the formation of the oceans and continents. At the time, though, Tharp's ideas were dismissed as girls' talk. My BBC colleague Louise Hidalgo picks up the story from here.
Continental drift was the theory that the great continents of the Earth had once been one supercontinent, a single landmass which had broken up and drifted apart over millions of years. The idea had been around for decades, but no established scientist believed it, even in the late 40s, when Marie Tharp first joined the Lamont Geological Laboratory at Columbia University. Then Marie used to say, to be a drifter, as she called it, could get you fired.
I had to cut and paste and replot.
Do you recall reactions or discussions among the broader geological community? Did anyone, for example, try to argue that it wasn't a fair representation?
Well, they not only said it wasn't fair, they said it was a bunch of lies.
Bill Ryan joined Columbia University as a young graduate student.
I landed in September of 1962 in the room right next to Marie Tharp. Can you imagine that? And so I had the opportunity to see her work as she developed maps of the South Atlantic and then of the Indian Oceans in an atmosphere where every faculty member at Columbia University was adamantly anti-continental drift, including the director of the lab. Only those of that time that could really talk comfortably about continental drift were the young graduate students who didn't know better to know all the reasons why drift couldn't occur.
But she did give you this very graphic lesson one day, didn't she, in this idea that the continents had once been joined. It was a kind of light bulb moment, wasn't it?
In her office, she had a globe that had been created by National Geographic, and it had a clear see-through plastic shell. And I remember one day, she put the shell over her rift valley, and she drew on the shell with a piece of charcoal the shape of her rift valley. And then she slid the see-through plastic shell so that that shape lined up with the edge of Africa, and it was the same. And she slid it over, and that rift valley ended up with the shape of the east coast of North America. And so this rift valley sat exactly in the middle with the shape of the two continents on the sides.
So the symmetry, because they're
too hard. Each piece of seafloor that's out there now, 100 miles away, 200 miles away, 300 miles away, was once together in the ancient rift valley. And so this identical signature is now split in two and carried to the two sides. We had this revolution we call the plate tectonic revolution. It was a Copernicus-like revolution, and we were in the middle of it. And it was just, for me, being in the right place at the right time.
And in the same room as the right person.
That's right.
As a young girl growing up in Michigan, Marie Tharp used to help her father do soil surveys for the Department of Agriculture. It would leave her with a lasting love of maps and of science. But in those days, when it came to a job, women were expected to stay in the background and analyse the data that the men, like her colleague geologist Bruce Hazen, brought back from the research ships.
She kept pretty much to herself, somewhat hidden.
What did people believe before this? What did they think was on the bottom of the ocean?
Well, according to Marie's own words, when she started her work, people considered the bottom of the oceans like the bottom of a giant bathtub, a flat plain filled with all the sediments that had washed off the continents in the hundreds to billions of years. But early work in laying the submarine cables in the late 1800s across the Atlantic had shown pretty much that there was a plateau in the center of the oceans. But they didn't have the echo-sounding technology until 1952, which was invented at Columbia University, to really show the profiles that could reveal an individual deep valley, this rift valley. And so then, with the help of an assistant, they plotted on the same map but on a different sheet onto these beautiful blue linens earthquakes from the earthquake catalogs. And she discovered that earthquakes aligned with her valley and that the earthquakes straddled around the world in a path of more than 40,000 miles. And so this crack was not just in the Atlantic Ocean, but it was probably in the other oceans as well. Her colleague Bruce Hazen also didn't accept the theory of continental drift and interpreted as maybe the Earth was expanding, and this was a crack that was appearing from an expanding Earth.
It took a year, but eventually Marie Tharp managed to convince Bruce Hazen that this was, in fact, part of the evidence of continental drift. In 1957, they finished their first map of the North Atlantic, but it would take several more years for the outside world to accept their thinking. In the meantime, Bruce Hazen's name appeared on the academic papers they published. Marie's did not.
Marie did not attend a lot of the seminars at the lab. She did not go to the international meetings. But there was one very important meeting held in 1959 of an International Congress on the Oceans in New York. And that's when the rest of the geological, geophysical community got for the first time to see her map of the Atlantic Ocean. And from that map, there was an enormous stir.
The great French filmmaker and oceanographer Jacques Cousteau came to that conference, didn't he? And Cousteau had been a vehement opponent of continental drift, but he'd heard about their work and he'd begun to rethink, hadn't he?
Cousteau had come to New York on his ship, the Calypso, and he'd put down a camera sled into her rift valley and had towed it across these lavas. And he presented at this Congress about a four-minute film, 16 millimeter, of a trip across these lava flows, and the audience gasped.
These flows were where the tectonic plates were pulling apart and molten material was oozing out of the earth and solidifying. It became known as seafloor spreading and was part of this revolutionary new theory that slowly began to gain acceptance. It wasn't really until towards the end of her life that her work was recognised, though, was it? She was named as one of the four most influential cartographers of the 20th century, but it wasn't really that that drove her, was it?
For her, her recognition would be her name on these extraordinary maps which lined the corridors of all of the universities and colleges. If you ask people of my age who lived through this time period, the ocean floor that we have memorized in our head is Marie Tharp's ocean floor, clearly as that.
Geologist Bill Ryan ending that report by the BBC's Louise Hidalgo. Her look back at the life and work of Marie Tharp, who died in 2006, was done for the Witness Program. We've got about a minute before the break, just enough time for a preview of a story that we'll have for you tomorrow. You'll hear from Saladin Ahmed. He's a science fiction and fantasy writer, a novelist, a poet, and he writes comics. Ahmed's the author of the Black Bolt series for Marvel Comics, and he's writing the rebooted Marvel series Exiles. Plus, he's got his own comic series for Boom Studios called Abbott. Quite the resume. Just don't ask him if he considers himself an Arab-American writer.
I always feel sorry for journalists like yourself because there's no right way to cover this, because if I'm described as an Arab American writer, I get resentful, right? Because I'm just a writer. But neglecting the fact that I'm Arab American also feels like sort of shorting what I'm trying to do in my work. I mean, my ethnic identity, my racial identity has always been a big part of how I see myself in the world. And I know it's been a big part of how the world sees me.
My conversation with Saladin Ahmed. That's on tomorrow's program. I'm Carol Hills. Actress Asia Argento was vilified by many in Italy after speaking out against sexual harassment.
In a way, I expected it, because they were always hostile with me, in the sense that I don't fit in the acceptable womanhood in Italy.
But she's not stopping. That story just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. This next story comes from our Across Women's Lives desk. It's about Italian actress Asia Argento. She was one of the first women to speak out about predatory sexual behavior by Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein. Argento became one of the most prominent voices of the Me Too movement around the world, but particularly in her native Italy. Then came the backlash. Argento was vilified by many in her home country. She was called a prostitute and blamed for the sexual assault she says she suffered at the hands of Weinstein. But that hasn't stopped Argento from speaking out. I recently met her while she was in Boston. Argento didn't pull any punches when we talked. And I should warn you, there's some explicit language in the conversation you're about to hear. Argento started off by telling me she was not surprised by the way Italians reacted.
In a way, I expected it, because they were always hostile with me, in the sense that I don't fit in the acceptable womanhood in Italy, in the sense that I've always been rebellious to the system and being pigeonholed as an actress and what an actress has to be. And it was always a rebellion with my movies. And so having always been an outcast, I feared that I could have been attacked, but I didn't expect, obviously, the complete slander of my character and slut-shaming.
Do you think that if you were a different, if you were a more stereotypical actress or, you know, Italian woman, professional, that the reaction would have been different? Do you think it was partly about you, Asia, or an image?
Yes, it's absolutely that. I know that it, because all the other victims coming from the States with the same predator were not assassinated in their character the way I was. So I know that it's because of me and because of what I've been, you know, free with my word, free with my body, free as a woman, free to say what I want, and unafraid to break this stereotype of the silent bourgeois actress who's submitted toward a male-dominated film world in Italy. And so, yes, it was directed against me.
If Sophia Loren came forward and said, I was, you know, abused by all these directors, do you think people would believe her because she's a more conventional idea?
Yes, there was actually an actress from her time, Gina Lollobrigida, who spoke out and everybody believed and nobody shamed her. But then there was another actress working on TV who accused a famous Italian director, and she was vilified because she was what they call a showgirl. And so people like us were not the perfect victims. And what is a perfect victim? You see, and that's the kind of thing, conversation we need to have, I need to have with people, and to make them realize that there's no such thing as the perfect victim. There's also an ideal of the act of rape. People in Italy, at least, you know, they were saying you were not raped because you were not tied up. You were not raped because you received oral sex. And oral sex is always a pleasure for women. This is what men said. So there needs to be a complete rewiring of knowledge, pretty much, of culture.
I'm wondering, though, if outside of the histrionics and the real character assassination, did you find quiet support among Italians, men and women?
I found support, like great support, from feminist groups, which are very independent. And this became a huge thing. What happened to me, it became their battle, mostly the power structure and the media that I think is afraid in a way to lose the chair under their butt, that we women are going to come in and take their place if we come out with our truth, and there's going to be some kind of equality, which is very feared in Italy, the advancement of women.
You left Italy after the worst of the criticism and treatment of you. You've returned. Why did you return?
I returned because I understood that my place is to be there. Because here, when I spoke my truth, it was like the door was ajar, and we give it a little push, and people were ready to believe women. While there, there's still a lot of work to do to even change the culture.
What tangible things can come out of the Me Too movement? For average women, there's lots of places where women are really harassed and abused, you know, working class women and in all sorts of environments. What is there for them to grab onto in this movement, given that they don't have a lot of power?
Well, I don't have a lot of power either, because if I had a lot of power, I wouldn't have been harassed. What needs to happen is equality, and this has to be transversal in all workplaces. You know, it's about every woman everywhere, and that's why they're talking about, you know, men with a twisted mind, puffed up egos, to feel that by dominating women, they are more powerful. And, you know, it's a delirium of omnipotence that some men have. And this change has to happen, of course, in the families and the way we teach boys.
You have a daughter, she's 16 years old. What kind of impact has this had on her, or how has it changed how you're talking to her about being an adult and what to expect?
Well, yes, we have had many conversations. I also have a 9-year-old boy. And my daughter was more open than her friends, and she came with me many times in the streets in Rome and elsewhere. And my son, what I saw was very interesting, what he saw, what was happening to me, and the conversations we had, and he calls it the revolution. Before, he used to say, you know, boys against girls, this kind of thing, and I was like, where is this coming from? It's like DNA. So he's being also rewired by this revolution, and I am sure he'll be a good man.
Has it been worth it for you? You took it a lot of heat, really tough stuff. Would you do it again?
Yes, undoubtedly. It's been, I think, the most important thing I've ever done in my life, the most difficult. It has given a new meaning to my life much more important than the film career. And I've done it for myself, of course, to free my truth, but I've done it for the others, and that's why I'm very proud of it. Whatever slandering and pain I've suffered, it's nothing compared to seeing finally something really global happening for women, uniting together. I've met so many women, now, you know, we're a group, we're a tribe of many women all over the world.
I read that you weren't going to act anymore. Is that true, or will you continue to act?
Many years ago, I lost my passion in acting. I started acting when I was 9. And for me, it was something never fulfilling, but it was a job that I respected and I did. But I was never an ambitious actor. So since 2013, it's not what I really want to do. It would need to be like a really great movie with a great director where I can learn mostly as a director more than an actress. It's not in my dreams, no.
And what are your immediate plans now? In terms of whether Me Too or film projects?
To stay alive. It's already very difficult every day, you know, to be able to wake up and tie my shoelaces and learn to live differently, because this has changed my life and I have to relearn how to live and who I am and how to be around other people.
Really? It's been that enormous. There's Asia before and there's Asia after?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Without any doubt.
And can you give an example of how you're living your life differently now than before?
Well, I've lived in a lot of fear. I'm still afraid to leave my apartment. I receive death threats, and so I have to learn not to be scared to live in Italy. But this is important for me, coming here, talking to people. I need to keep this conversation going, because I know it's the most important thing I have witnessed in my lifetime for women. And this is what Me Too is about, is empathy towards somebody else that reminds you of your own trauma, of your own experience, and then to be able to voice it, because that's the freedom, like it's the liberation, when you're able to say, yes, it happened to me too. Yes, I'm still here. Yes, you know, now I need to help others.
Italian actress Asia Argento. Our conversation was part of our Across Women's Lives coverage. Be sure to check out our Across Women's Lives on Facebook for more. On January 29, 2017, Alexandre Bissonnette walked into a mosque in Quebec City with a gun and opened fire. The 27-year-old killed 6 people and seriously injured 5 others who'd gathered to pray. Last month, Bissonnette pleaded guilty, and now he's back in court for sentencing. As part of that process, victims and their families have been giving testimony. Kate McKenna is a reporter for the CBC based in Montreal. Kate, what have victims been saying about the attack in court?
Oh, we've been hearing devastating victim impact statements over the last couple of days about people who were both inside the mosque when it happened and then also the widows of some of the people who died in the attack. One thing we've been hearing over and over again is about one of the men who did die, Ezzedine Soufiane. We've heard over and over in testimony in court that he tried to prevent Alexandre Bissonnette from killing more people. He charged the shooter and then the shooter killed him in cold blood. So we've been hearing a lot about him, a lot about his bravery. The shooting killed the fathers of 17 children. So we've been hearing from the wives, the widows who say, you know, my young children are growing up without their father. Some of them won't even remember their father, and that's devastating to me, and that it's been very difficult for me to kind of move past this and understand what happened. And then for the people who are inside the mosque, some of whom, you know, sustained injuries, some of them were seen on video surveillance tape shepherding kids out of there when Alexandre Bissonnette opened fire. And one of the most devastating testimonies that came from the victim impact statement yesterday was a man who was in the mosque that night saying, from now on, whenever he's in a space, he looks around and sees, where are the kids? Where would I take the kids in the event that a shooting happened here right now? So it's something that is still, you know, more than a year, very present in people's minds.
It's unbelievable. Let's go back to the context of this shooting in 2017. At the time, President Trump had just announced a travel ban on people from several majority Muslim countries. And in response, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had tweeted a message of support to refugees, welcoming them to Canada. What do we know about the shooter, Alexandre Bissonnette, and whether this influenced him?
I was in the courtroom when this came up, and this was probably the most silent room I've ever been in my entire life. So as you mentioned, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has been largely pro-immigration. So he tweeted, "To those fleeing persecution, terror, and war, Canadians will welcome you regardless of your faith. Diversity is our strength." In an interrogation video that was taken just hours after the attack, Alexandre Bissonnette told a police officer, you know, that was the clinchpin for him. He couldn't understand why Canadians would want to take immigrants that the Americans wouldn't want to take. And he said that's what pushed him to ultimately perpetrate this attack. And he believed at the time that he was saving people from a terrorist attack and that he was going to go into the woods afterwards and shoot himself, which of course is not what happened. He was apprehended by police and taken into custody. But in the courtroom during that time, the victims are there of the mosque shooting. The widows are there. People from the Muslim community are there. And it was just silent. And then finally, a few people just started kind of weeping quietly.
What new information about Bissonnette's motivations have come out during the sentencing?
Oh, all of it, basically. I mean, I was one of the journalists who scoured his Facebook and his online presence to try and determine what happened just after the shooting. But until that interrogation video came out on Friday, I believe, we never heard from him why he did it. He spoke with a social worker who worked in prison, who he kind of gave a slightly different perspective of what he was trying to do. He said he was looking for glory when he went into the mosque and killed people, that he could have targeted anybody. He said he regretted not killing more people. We also know from a 45-page report that was tabled by the prosecution that looked at the contents of Alexandre Bissonnette's computer that he was kind of obsessively searching for Donald Trump. He was checking his tweets every day. He was really interested in what Donald Trump was doing and also interested in members of the alt-right. So he had a real interest in immigration. And we also know from the contents of his computer that he was negatively obsessed with feminism and firearms. He had a selfie of himself wearing a Make America Great Again hat. And we also know that he had been Googling the mosque in Quebec City.
Some are saying that Bissonnette could receive the harshest sentence since Canada abolished the death penalty in 1976. What kind of sentence do you think is likely?
Okay, so in Canada, the base sentence for first-degree murder is life with eligibility for parole after 25 years. So he will get that for sure. The question here is, because there were 6 counts of first-degree murder, whether or not they will be concurrent. So that would take him up to 150 years before being eligible for parole. So what we've seen so far in the sentencing hearings is the Crown trying to show the severity of the crime, show that they were premeditated, show that he is not really remorseful, despite saying that he was remorseful when he pleaded guilty, and kind of establish that this is a really serious thing and the sentences should be concurrent. However, there is a question about whether or not in Canadian law that is constitutional to basically lock someone up for the rest of their life. So that is going to be the second part of the sentencing hearing, I think it's safe to assume, and that will probably be what the defense says. So it's up to this Quebec City judge to kind of weigh that. Certainly from the victim impact statements we've been hearing, the people who were affected by this most would like to see him put away for the rest of his life.
Kate McKenna is a CBC reporter based in Montreal. Thanks a lot, Kate.
Thank you so much.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World.
And I'm Marco Werman, just turning the tables for a brief moment, really to talk about a guest we had earlier this week on the show, Filipino-American artist Bren Bataclan. He lives just over the river in Cambridge. And when he first moved to the Boston area, he said he wanted to fit in, find his community. And one way he did that was by leaving some of his paintings just around the city. If you found one and you liked it, you took it. A totally random act of kindness. And then we asked you to share your random act of kindness on our Facebook page. And we've received so many stories and comments. Some are long, some are short, but all really poignant. And I just want to share one with you, Carol. This is from Taylor Ash Lee, who writes, "I like to feed other people's parking meters when they've gone red. Maybe they'll never know, but I have the satisfaction of possibly saving them from a parking ticket."
That's incredibly generous of her.
Isn't that cool? These are just stories about, you know, picking up someone's tab in a restaurant when the person was broke, or giving a ride to a stranger in need, offering a hot cup of tea to someone standing in the rain with a flat bicycle tire. There are so many random acts of kindness out there. And if you go through some of them on our Facebook page, a fair warning, get your hankies ready. Anyway, we're asking you to tell us about your random acts of kindness, whether you gave it or whether you received it. Bren Bataclan will pick his two favorite stories, and those people will receive one of his paintings.
Details and photos of the paintings are at the World's Facebook page. Just drop your random act of kindness on the pinned post. And finally today, Los Angeles is full of neighborhoods named after the immigrant communities who live in them, or used to live in them. There's Koreatown, Little Tokyo, and more. So what do you call a neighborhood in Mexico City that's getting popular among Mexican-American immigrants? Emily Green takes us to a part of town that's recently become known as Little L.A.
The neighborhood started changing when a massive bilingual call center opened a few years back. It started hiring young, bilingual Mexicans who grew up in the U.S. and were back in Mexico by force or choice. The nickname Little L.A. started taking hold, referring to the street corner where the young men hung out between shifts, speaking English.
Around there, that's the little hood over there. Reminds us of back in the days.
Mikey Baez grew up in the U.S. and was deported 5 years ago when he was 19. He likes Little L.A. because he doesn't feel self-conscious speaking English like in other parts of the city, he says.
When you hear people speaking English, you feel a little more comfortable. We speak Spanish and everything, but our main language is always going to be English at the end of the day. We ain't going to forget it.
And you don't necessarily know you're in Little L.A. just from the looks of the place. It's in an historic neighborhood centered around a huge dome structure commemorating the Mexican Revolution. But listen carefully, and you will hear English.
What's up? We're still here in downtown. We're going to head over there. I'll be right there like in 30 minutes, man.
Diana Mendez grew up in Southern California and returned to Mexico with her family when she was 15. She's 22 now. She says it's not just English that connects people here. It's what they have in common that makes this slice of the city feel like Little L.A.
Because of what you went through over there and what you know from over there. It's not only the English, but the mindset we all have.
That mindset, for her, is about growing up in the States, going to high school there, sharing the same cultural references, the same jokes. They also connect over food. Alex Valdez, who's 34, spent 17 years in Chicago until he was deported 2 years ago. He still feels more comfortable speaking in Spanish. But while he was in the U.S. all those years, he picked up a taste for hamburgers and burritos. Burritos, by the way, are not a thing in Mexico City. This is taco country.
Tanto tiempo allá y entonces dije, pues si pongo un negocio aquí a un lado de chavos que...
Valdez says he spent so much time in the U.S., he thought maybe if he started a food truck close to other people accustomed to American food, he could do well. He was right. Business is booming. The increase of Mexicans here, raised in the U.S., is also having an impact on Mexicans who grew up here. Patty Cervantes is getting a haircut in a barbershop near Valdez's food truck. This is a new thing for him.
Existían estas barberías, pero eran normalmente las usaban gente mayor de mi abuelo.
He says barbershops always existed, but he felt like they were for older people, like his grandpa. When the call centers opened in this neighborhood, though, barbershops began opening too, catering to young guys like him. All of a sudden, it was cool to go. At the barbershop, customers catch up and talk about motorcycles.
That's a bad boy bike, though. You send me that? It's a bad boy bike.
Edwin Malagon cuts hair here. When he was deported back to Mexico, he found work at one of the call centers and at this barbershop. It's run by an elderly man everyone calls Pops.
When I came over here, it was Pops' customers. It was just older people coming with him just to get a haircut. And when I got here, I brought the new style, the fade and everything. So I started building up clientele from the call centers, like my co-workers. And they would look at me different, like, oh, look at this kid bringing the fades and the reggaeton and the hip-hop and all that stuff, right? But to me, it was normal because it was a culture from the States.
Malagon also says that Little L.A. isn't just becoming a meeting place for people who spent years in the U.S. and are now back in Mexico. He says he's bumping into people from Central America and other parts of Latin America, too.
I see, like, a diversity just like in the States, a diversity of cultures, diversity of people. I see that, and it helped me.
Diversity that, he says, will continue to grow and help others. For The World, Emily Green, Mexico City.
Pops shouldn't be surprised by Caribbeans who wander into his Mexico City barbershop either. Jamaican reggae's found a place in the DF too. This track comes courtesy of Mexico City producer and artist Camilo Lara, better known as Mexican Institute of Sound. Here he's joined by reggae legends Toots Hibbert of Toots and the Maytals fame on vocals and Sly and Robbie on drum and bass.
She's the winner. She's the rebel in the sky. She's a fighter. She kept her guard up. All for something. Something good. Yeah, yeah.
Music from Mexican Institute of Sound. Cosmopolitan DF is on the DL no more. That's our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.